It's Monday morning. It's 6 after 9, and that means it's All Things Political. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. As usual, there's lots of political news to talk about today, including several primaries coming up tomorrow in Kansas, Missouri, and Michigan. The GOP races there are tight and getting uglier by the minute. Meanwhile, some Republicans are urging their fellow party members to use caution when trying to make hay out of the Charlie Rangel mess. And there's a lot more to talk about. I'll start by apologizing if you hear grinding and pounding in the background. They're doing some work on the building where my studio lives this morning, and, well, we'll just have to live with it. My guest this morning is Michael Lynch, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Kansas. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the primaries, and there's one in Kansas, primaries for both the Senate and governor races. The action really all on the GOP side. What's happening in Kansas?
What's a very exciting year this year in Kansas. Brownback, our current senator, is running for governor, so there's an open seat for governor, and there's an open seat for the Senate, and two House of Representative members are running for the Senate, so we have three open seats for the House of Representatives as well. So lots of exciting races going on. So I guess the most action is definitely the Senate race between Todd Tehart and Jerry Moran. They're both sitting U.S. members of Congress and running to try to differentiate themselves, which is very hard because their voting records are almost identical.
Well, and it's gotten very personal in the
very
late
personal
days of the campaign.
Yeah, well, that's right. Both of them are making claims that I think are pushing the limits of what the voters should probably put up with, both accusing the other ones of being for amnesty on the immigration issues, both accusing each other of being soft on taxes. And we just see a lot of rancor that I don't know that we'd see if there was a more viable Democratic candidate, but there's probably not going to be a very strong contender on the Democratic side. So this is the real race, and because of that, it's an all-out fight.
Yeah, that's really it in Kansas, isn't it? Whoever wins this primary pretty much will be winning in November.
I think that's definitely true.
Okay, and what about the gubernatorial race? Senator Brownback is running, and he would be leading the pack on the Republican side there. What's your take on that?
Yeah, he seems like a shoo-in for that particular election. His only opponent on the ballot, her name is Heffington. She's a very unusual candidate. She's worried, among other things, about the CIA and government maybe putting microchips in the place of in people and monitoring them. She's also convinced that the Brownback campaign has bribed the media to not pay attention to her campaign. So I want to make sure I mention her name so people would know I'm not on the take.
Okay.
But because of that, I think Brownback is clearly going to win, and the Democratic candidate who will probably win and run against him, I think, is going to have a long fight. His name's Tom Holland, and it's going to be a very difficult campaign for him to make up for the war chest that Brownback has and the name recognition that he has in the state.
Well, how did Governor Sebelius, a Democrat, get elected there?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that Kansas has something of a three-party system. There are Democrats, there are more right-wing Republicans, and moderate Republicans. And Sebelius and other Democrats who've been successful in Kansas recently have brought the moderate Republicans in to the coalition. Our current governor was the lieutenant governor under Kathleen Sebelius, and also a former head of the Republican Party here in Kansas. So he changed parties to run as her running mate. He's our current governor and listed as a Democrat, but he has a background as being a moderate Republican. And that's how a lot of the races in Kansas are shaping up. It's, you try to figure out which Republican will win the primary, and Democrats, of course, have the best chance when a more conservative Republican wins.
Well, on the Senate side, then, I mean, the two Republicans are arguing over who's more conservative.
Right, and I think that has a lot to do with who votes in a primary versus who votes in the general election, right? So I think most of us expect for there to be about 20% turnout among registered voters tomorrow, as opposed to, you know, historically something more about 50% for the general election. Who votes in primaries? You know, the people who vote in primaries are the most conservative on the Republican side and the most liberal on the Democratic side. So because of the lack of a strong candidate on the Democratic side, they can run to the right and probably not risk being punished in the general election before for that. You can think of some other races in the country where that may be a little less true. I think of Reid in Nevada and Engel running against him, where some of the statements she's made in the primary election to try to win that primary maybe have made her vulnerable in the general election, and Reid's trying to paint her as an extremist now. I just don't think the two Republican candidates have fear of that happening to them, given the Democratic pool.
All right. Well, your neighbor to the east, Missouri, also has a primary, and I see that Joe the Plumber has weighed in against Roy Blunt in the Senate race there. Is that going to make any difference?
Well, so a little background on that. The candidate's name is Chuck Pargason, and he's kind of a darling of the Tea Party. And there's been some controversy. Joe the Plumber has come and supported him and tried to get people to not vote for Roy Blunt. Michelle Bachmann endorsed Roy Blunt and actually made a lot of Tea Party groups very angry with her for doing that. He voted for TARP, and he voted for the Cash for Clunkers bills, and there's just a lot of anger, I think, in the right wing of the Republican Party because of that. That said, I think that race has some of the problems that Tea Party darlings have in a lot of parts of the country. Not very well organized. There's not a lot of campaign contributions. There's not a lot of ads and spending. The Joe the Plumber helped Chuck Pergerson make an ad, but the ad hasn't appeared on TV as far as I know, because there hasn't been enough cash to buy airspace. So I think in the end, you know, Roy Blunt will probably survive. And my guess is a lot of Tea Party faithful will be a little disenchanted with the outcome of that primary.
Okay. Michigan is the other state where there's a primary tomorrow, and there's a pretty hot primary race for governor. And once again, the debate getting pretty ugly as Republicans try to outmaneuver each other to the right, except for
right.
A fellow by the name of Cox, who's the former head of Gateway, I believe, who is deliberately running as a moderate. That's a pretty bold strategy.
Rick Schneider, I guess. That's his name.
That's right.
The Gateway candidate. So Michigan has an open primary, unlike the Republican primary here in Kansas. So the day you show up, you can tell them which party you'd like to vote for. And Rick Schneider has the support of a lot of moderates, including Governor Milliken, which is a former governor of the state and a very popular moderate. I think his plan is to request that Democrats and independents think about voting for him in the primary. And right now he's ahead in the polls. Now, ahead in the polls, I should say, it's basically a three-way tie when you consider the margin of errors in these polls between Mike Cox, who's the attorney general, and Pete Hoekstra, who's a current U.S. House representative. And then Rick Schneider is just barely in the lead as of today. This is a really interesting race because you have Cox and Hoekstra really fighting to be the true conservative. And then at the same time, you have Schneider trying to make this case that being a politician, and in this case governor, should be about competence, not ideology, and he's touting his business experience and really talking about what needs to be done to fix the economy as opposed to what needs to be done to be the true conservative. In a state with 13.5% unemployment, I can see why that's resonating, and his success in the polls has really been fairly recent. Who decides to vote tomorrow is going to have a huge impact on that. If Democrats and independents do cross over and decide to vote in the primary, he could have a surprise win there.
Well, we know, of course, that elections aren't won by slogans or ideology or any of that. It's who can get their people to go vote, who's organized, and who can get their people to the polls to mark the ballot or pull the lever or whatever they do. Cox and Hoekstra in that race have been competing for the Tea Party vote. Which one of them right now did the Tea Party endorse either one of those two?
So this is another issue in general with candidates trying to go after Tea Party voters. There isn't a Tea Party. There's lots of Tea Parties. If you ask someone who's a leader in one of the organizations, are you the Tea Party? You know, I don't think any of them can claim that. Because that, who endorses someone on behalf of the Tea Party is a little unclear. I think that's certainly true for this race. Hoekstra quickly, I think he is considered a co-founder of the new House Tea Party Caucus that Michelle Bachmann put together. So he's certainly trying to put together those kind of coalitions. Cox is doing the same thing, but again, there's just no one thing you can point to and say, yes, you're the Tea Party candidate, and this is how I know. I guess, you know, to some extent, Sarah Palin's endorsement, I guess, is seen by some as being the closest thing we have to that. But she's been a little stingy in who she's endorsed and in which races.
Okay. Well, let's go to a general question about these primaries here, and then we'll start taking some phone calls. Three primaries tomorrow. What should we be looking for that might tell us something about what's going to be happening in November across the country? Or can we just not take anything from any of these primaries and extrapolate out several months?
Well, so I guess there's two big issues. One is simply that the people who vote in these primaries are not the same people who vote in the general election. I mean, people who vote in primaries do vote in the general election, but there are just so many more people that vote in the general election. Looking at a race like some of the races we're talking about today and extrapolating what the mood of the state is, I think it is pretty tough to do. A great example of that is something called Proposition C, which is going to be voted on in Missouri, and it's basically a proposition that would make it illegal to compel people to participate in any health care system. And this is obviously a proposition that's directly opposed to the Obama health care package. You know, given that there are a lot of Republicans that are going to be voting because there's a lot of important Republican races, my guess is it's going to pass, and it's going to pass with a great margin. I don't know that it would be at all appropriate for us to read into that you know, the public is against Obamacare. I think the right thing to believe is that Republican primary voters are against Obamacare. So I guess that's one major point. The other major point is I think a lot of the issues that are important in these races don't have nearly as much resonance to general election voters. An example of that is in Kansas, the Secretary of State contest features a candidate named Kris Kobach. Kris Kobach has gone to Arizona and actually helped write the Senate bill that's the center of the anti-immigrant controversy right now in Arizona, and he's running for Secretary of State as a you know, the prime focus of his campaign is stopping illegal immigration. Now, you know, there's some questions about how exactly the Secretary of State would be able to do that. While this is of prime importance to this race, I don't know that in the general election in Kansas, something like illegal immigration is going to have as much traction with moderate Republican, independent, and Democratic voters. You know, if you ask people what the top issues are today, immigration is pretty far down the list. Obviously, the economy, unemployment, health care, these are much more important on kind of the list of things to do in most voters' minds.
It's All Things Political for this Monday morning, the very first Monday of the month of August. And John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. My guest, Michael Lynch, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Kansas. We've been talking about the primaries. Lots of other really important political news to talk about, and you're certainly welcome to weigh in on anything you think is important politically at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, the address talk@wpr.org, and there's also a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page where you can go and leave a comment as well, and then we'll share that with the radio audience. When we come back, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Charlie Rangel and his situation and how that's going to affect the Democrats coming up in November, or will it? You've got conservative pundit Bill Kristol saying yesterday Republicans should just shut up about Charlie Rangel. Well, we'll talk about what his point is there, and we'll take your calls in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's just about 9:22. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR, and here's what's coming up a little bit later on today. After 2 o'clock on Talk of the Nation, Mary Roach wanted answers to some of the most pressing questions about life in outer space, like sex and going to the bathroom. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, Mary Roach talks about her book, Packing for Mars, with guest host Tony Cox. That's after 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political on the Kathleen Dunn program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. My guest, Michael Lynch, assistant professor of political science at the University of Kansas. Over the weekend, of course, there was a lot of discussion on the Sunday morning political talk shows and elsewhere about Charlie Rangel and his ethics problems. Of course, some Republicans jumping on that and talking about, you know, how bad the Democrats are. Bill Kristol saying, hey, just shut up about it, because, you know, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones sort of thing. What about Charlie Rangel's problems? How bad are they? And what about Kristol's advice?
Well, there's some fairly serious allegations. My guess is he'll be admonished in some way, and that might be the end of it. He's already had problems with, you know, questions raised about his chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee. This is one of those issues that I think is very important to people who focus on politics all the time, but I'm always a little dubious that voters in November are going to remember this. That said, there's some other key Democrats. Maxine Waters is looking like she may be headed down the same path as Charlie Rangel with some ethics problems, and she may be, instead of compromising with the ethics committee, she may actually go to a trial the same way Rangel does. So this, you know, this issue is in terms of, you know, senior Democratic leaders having ethics issues, it could continue on for some more time, which, you know, obviously Democratic leadership would not be happy about.
Well, the irony here is that some of Rangel's problems are in large part because of the tougher ethics rules that Democrats have put in place. You know, he would have gotten a little tap on the wrist, or, you know, somebody would have shaken their finger at him and there wouldn't have been a problem. But the Democrats put these rules in. I mean, doesn't this look, I would think, in a way, one way to spin this, I guess, and that's what this is all about, would be to say, well, look, you know, we said we were putting in tougher rules. We put them in. We're prosecuting one of our own, and maybe point to things that didn't happen in previous Congresses. I don't know.
No, I think if this becomes an issue, that's exactly how Democrats should focus on this. And, you know, I think that's exactly where Bill Kristol's coming from, is this may not be a winning issue to have both parties listing the litany of ethics violations that their senior members have committed in recent years. I just don't think this is an issue that probably has a lot of traction for voters, given all our economic woes. It makes a lot of sense to let this one go. But Democrats do have this claim that, hey, we're actually bringing these two individuals to trial and taking these charges seriously and trying to clean house.
Well, let's hear from Dave in Menominee, Michigan, who wants to weigh in on the Charlie Rangel issue. Dave, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. I am just stunned that, you know, even the so-called, which I don't believe it is, the so-called liberal media is constantly bringing up Charlie Rangel and the Democrats' problems. There's a guy from Nevada named John Ensign. Now, this guy had an extramarital affair. He covered it up. He paid the family of his mistress $96,000. Each member of the family got $12,000 per shot to basically cover this thing up, keep it quiet. Now, Senator Tom Colburn from Oklahoma, Ensign is from Nevada. Tom Colburn from Oklahoma says he's a priest, and he was counseling Ensign. So all of their conversations were being held, you know, to confidentiality. But now Colburn has turned over 1,200 pages of documents and emails related to this thing, and it is a messy, sloppy sex probe, and nobody's talking about it. Now, if this was a Democrat, we'd be all over it. Now, why is that?
Professor, you want to tackle that one?
I think part of it just has to do with where we are in the process with those two things. Rangel's actually going through the process in the House of being investigated. The House has slightly different rules on ethics and an ethics committee that I would say is a little more aggressive right now. I think the Ensign story is certainly not dead and may come to the light a little more when we hear a little more about what happened with these emails, but, you know, as far as I know there are emails, but I'm not exactly sure what's in them. I don't know that this is any kind of bias on either part of the media, and I think the caller has done a great job of explaining why Bill Kristol thinks no one should bring up ethics at all in campaigns, because it's a difficult issue for both parties, depending on which figure you'd like to discuss.
Well, I mean, you can trot out a long list of Republicans who've had ethical issues, just like you can trot out a long list of Democrats who've had them. It's this may be more fuel on the fire of the let's throw everybody out, they're all crooks kind of thing.
Right, which I don't think either party is very excited to help fuel those flames. That's already pretty strong sentiment in the country right now.
Yeah, but I think Dave makes the point, though, and Bill Kristol, I believe, did refer to Senator Ensign and others who's, hey, you know, we don't want to have this debate right now because it's just it's not going to go well for us. Thanks a lot for the call, Dave. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. That is the email address. And you can also go to Facebook and leave a message there. Go find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page, the Facebook fan page for the program, and you can leave a message there, and we'll try and pass that along. There was an article on Politico. You alluded to something earlier when you talked about the referendum coming up in Missouri on health care. There was a story in Politico that it was from this morning basically saying Republicans may not be able to repeal the Democrats' health care reform law next year, but they're eyeing the next best thing. This assumes they retake Congress, deny the Obama administration the money it needs to implement the law. So they're looking at that. Whatever your position on health care, how do you think people would respond in that case when things have been promised, the law has been passed, and then someone says, oh, you know what, we're taking that off the table?
Well, I guess I'm a little dubious of how successful that would be. I mean, the executive branch has a lot of devices available to them to try to set this up. It would be pretty hard to explain to the voters that you're blocking the parts of the bill that are that need acquiescence from Congress that actually give people health care, but you can't block the parts of the bill that are doing things I think a lot of people are not very excited about, like raising taxes. It would be a difficult issue. I think it's maybe a better rhetorical line for the Republicans than an actual strategy. I don't know. I'm a little dubious that we'll actually see them try to do that. Things like this issue in Missouri, you know, that proposition, even if it passes, is I think probably most scholars I've read do not think this is going to be viewed as constitutional. Right, this is allowing a state to supersede a federal law, which is pretty unlikely. The real battle here is going to be in the courts, and we kind of have to wait for that to happen, I think.
All right. Well, we've got a caller. Let's talk to Jim in Milwaukee next. Jim, good morning.
Yes, hi. I'd like to talk about the incident with Ms. Sherrod and the process of self-deception that I see in some conservative thinkers. And I start out from the get-go admitting that politicians from both parties manifest character deficiencies at times as individuals. But what I think we're talking about here is a pattern of behavior. And it seems to me that the difficulty that the conservatives have in dealing with the Sherrod issue is that the truth hurts, and so there's a necessity to justify and minimize and divert to take away from the fact that there has been a pattern of behavior of misleading people for the purpose of doing harm. And I'd ask you and the listening audience to empathize with how a woman would feel in your family related to you, if it was your grandma or your wife, your mother, your sister or daughter, and they were their reputation was being attacked by people that were slandering and lying, assaulting their reputation, depriving them of their livelihood, threatening their middle-class status because they would lose their job. And this is basically what happened to Ms. Sherrod. And the problem was in the case is that the media in the past have had the tendency to, they report these situations that come up with this situation and also the situation with the advocacy group ACORN, but then when the material comes out to turns out to be false and manipulated, they don't correct the issue, and of course we don't see the conservative politicians correcting the issue either, because the end justifies the means in terms of fomenting divide and conquer, and so I think that the thing that people don't want to deal with is that this cheating behavior was not an aberration, but a pattern of behavior inflicted upon people with the sanction of the Fox network. And yet to admit that you voted for people who perpetrate this kind of behavior is just unacceptable to a person. So they have to justify and minimize and divert and come up with some excuse not to accept what they actually have voted for.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Professor, what about the Shirley Sherrod case and Jim's comments that this is part of a pattern of behavior?
Well, I it's a pattern of behavior that both parties participate in and have since the founding of our nation, right? A selective use of the facts or slightly misleading statements are part of the history of American politics. There's obviously an ugly side to that, and I think the Sherrod case is a clear example of that, where a single individual singled out and loses her job because of an incomplete transcript of her speech.
That's being polite.
Around, it seems like, because the Obama administration it sounds like pressured her to give up her job before the facts came out. Some news media organizations. Seems to have kind of jumped the gun on this one, and I just don't think there's not a lot of innocence on this one, except maybe in Ms. Sherrod's case.
Well, I think you're being a little generous in terms of your description of what was done in the case of Shirley Sherrod. I mean, I personally think she has a, even in spite of New York Times versus Sullivan, she has a slam dunk libel case against the person who manipulated the information in the first place,
right.
And probably
and I believe she has filed suit.
She certainly could pass the malice test here, and every network that ran with that story without checking it would be guilty of the same reckless disregard for truth that the originator was.
And I guess, for certain elements of the Republican and Democratic Party that play these games, I mean, in a sad way, that's their job, and the media's job is to stop them. And I guess my takeaway from all this is maybe more disappointment in the media than anyone else. And again, the Obama administration, if they did pressure her to resign, they also failed to do due diligence. So it's a pretty disappointing episode all the way around, I would say.
Well, there was a lot of overreaction. Speaking of President Obama, he was in Detroit last week talking. Basically, he said that the Republicans had it wrong on the auto bailout and that millions of jobs were saved. And now the auto manufacturing sector is on its way back to health. I mean, Ford's actually making money, although they didn't get the bailout. GM seems to be stable. Chrysler isn't hemorrhaging cash as much as they were. They still haven't turned a profit yet. The president even drove a new Chevy Volt about 10 feet. What was your takeaway from President Obama's trip to Michigan last week?
Well, I mean, he's hitting on all the right points, right? The obvious weakness for Democrats and Obama coming into this midterm is that the economy is still poor. Unemployment rates are high. Consumer confidence is down. Every indication you'd look at to talk about the strength of the economy seems to be pretty stagnant or in some cases going the wrong direction. You know, convincing the voters that the stimulus in its various forms mattered and had an impact, I think, is a key thing for Democrats to do. Obviously, this is hard to do. You know, for us to know whether the stimulus mattered or not, we don't live in a world where we can give half of us the stimulus and half of us not and see if it worked. You know, both parties are going to try to interpret the facts on the ground. And even before the stimulus was passed, I told some of my students that it seems pretty clear to me, regardless of what happens, the Democrats will claim victory and the Republicans will claim it didn't work. You know, scholars are still fighting about whether Roosevelt helped or hurt during the Great Depression. So even with 80 years of hindsight, sometimes these things are a little hard to ferret out.
All right. Our next caller will be Matthew from Middleton. Matthew, good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering about two things here. One is state nullification of a federal law. And a good example of that happening was the Real ID Act that was passed by the federal government. 26 states said, forget it, not part of authority delegated to Congress. And we basically have a federal law that says we should have a national ID, and none of the states have it. So you already are hearing several states saying that, you know, they can try and tax us, and we're just not going to pay anything to the federal government for this. And the second is, I think it's... I have a hard time listening on the radio when I hear the federal government passed the law, but yet there's no discussion of what the limits of the federal government are. I mean, what we're hearing is essentially anything can be passed under the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that, I think, to a lot of people just isn't going to fly.
All right. Well, maybe we need to do a program on constitutional law. I wouldn't be opposed to that. That was one of my favorite topics as a political science student in college. But, Professor, what about state nullification of the health care law? You alluded earlier, this is going to end up in the courts and be decided there.
Right. And I think the issue that will end up in the courts is not an individual state ability to nullify the law. I don't really see a lot of legal support for that case. I think where the issue is going to end up being is whether Congress has the authority to compel people to purchase anything, in this case health care policies. And I guess I have to say, con law was one of my favorite classes, but not one I teach, so I suggest you have another show, too. Maybe not invite me as a guest and talk about the Tenth Amendment and nullification in a little more detail. I'm afraid it's just something
I won't. I won't ask you to give an opinion on what you think the limits of federal power are under the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution.
I appreciate that.
No problem.
I definitely would like to defer to someone else.
Well, I used to actually teach a mass communications law course, so that was an area that I have a little more knowledge of. My constitutional law class is, let's say, more than three decades behind me. I probably could explain Marbury versus Madison, but that's about as far as I would.
I know that one too,
okay.
But I'm not sure that has much to do with the midterm elections.
Okay, Matthew, thanks for that call. And I think that was a great idea for a show. Producer's note, maybe a program on the limits of federal power under the Commerce Clause. Let's get a constitutional scholar on and talk about that issue. Great idea. I'm hoping I'm the guest host that day. 800-642-1234, that's the number to call. It's All Things Political for a Monday morning. This is the first Monday in August. You can join us if you've got a political story that we haven't touched yet. We haven't gotten to a lot of them. There's been some interesting discussion, some great calls this morning. 800-642-1234. Lines are available right now. Lots of them. You can get in, and you'll get on the air. We'll try and get to everybody who calls. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or you can go to Facebook, find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page, and leave a comment there. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just about 18 minutes before 10 o'clock, coming up after 10, I'll be talking with a physicist who says, for him, gravity doesn't exist. Well, there's an old saying, you may not believe in gravity, but gravity believes in you. We'll find out what our guest string theory expert has to say about Newton's universe and Einstein and so forth. There probably will be math. I hope that doesn't scare you off, because I think it'll be a fascinating hour. This hour, it's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest is Michael Lynch, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Kansas. One of the things that has been floated out there, and again, this is a story I read, I'm trying to remember which, there are so many websites with news now, I'm trying to remember which one I read this on. There is some consideration in the Democratic camp to run against President Bush again in this midterm election. That seems like a risky gambit for the Democrats to use. But boy, are they scraping the peanut butter jar here, looking for issues?
Well, I think the best political science research on what really drives people's voting decision points to them voters kind of considering what their situation is like and being angry with the incumbents if things are going badly and happy with them if things are going well. And obviously with all the economic news now, this is something that definitely concerns the Democrats. Because of that, focusing on Bush makes some sense, I think, especially because the Bush tax cuts, the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, are up for renewal. It's something I don't believe we've mentioned yet today, but this is going to be a key issue in November. It seems likely that sometime between now and then, the House and Senate will have to decide whether to extend all or some of the Bush tax cuts or none of them as the most unlikely choice. But these are real issues that definitely affect people in a way that a lot of other laws aren't. You can actually type your information into some computer programs and it will tell you what your taxes are with and without the tax cuts extended. And, you know, when you can put a dollar amount on what your vote costs, that's going to have a real impact on people's decisions.
Well, I mean, is it that important that Congress deal with this one way or the other? I mean, could they just let it go and say, well, that was, you know, was a dumb idea to begin with, and we're done with it now?
Well, they could let it go, but virtually everyone in the country's taxes would go up, and that would certainly not be popular, and it would be a direct conflict with Obama's presidential promise to not raise taxes on middle class or poor. You know, again, this is an unusual law. Well, not unusual, but it's a law that has a sunset provision, both of these. So, you know, after 2010, these tax cuts all disappear, and the rates go back to the levels they were at in 2000 before this legislation was passed. And these are some pretty big increases. The 10-year cost of these tax cuts, if we allow them to stick around, is something along the lines of $4 trillion. So this is a lot of revenue we're talking about, and this is a major issue, in my opinion, that'll definitely affect the November elections.
Well, what about, I mean, there's a certain, well, I'll just say what it looks like. There's a certain amount of hypocrisy on the part, then, of those who are crying about the deficit. You know, I mean, if this would add to the deficit just as it created a deficit in the
right
first place.
Well, I think just to information for your listeners, you know, all the estimates you see of long-term deficit and debt projections assume that these tax cuts all go away. Those projections generally also assume that next year there'll be no wars and that we'll never have a hurricane or anything bad happen to us. So the estimates are always on a horribly unconservative side of things, where, you know, future costs are almost guaranteed to be higher than the projections. In this case, you know, we're talking about a $4 trillion difference. In a typical year, the entire federal government spends somewhere around, I don't know, like $3 trillion, I believe. So this is a, you know, to actually cut enough programs to make up for that and have tax cuts that continue but don't affect the deficit and debt. I mean, these are very draconian cuts we'd be talking about. And Republicans and Democrats, you know, I haven't heard anyone, only a few members of Congress willing to say, hey, I think we need big cuts to defense spending, to Social Security, to Medicare. I mean, these are the kind of programs we'd have to make cuts to, and those are just not going to be popular decisions. Historically, Americans like low taxes and government program. The problem is we can't have both of those without offsetting deficits.
We want to have our cake and eat it too. At some point, somebody has to stand up and say, "Excuse me, but the emperor is not wearing any clothes."
I strongly agree.
Okay. Let's go to Eastern Minnesota and take a call from Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thank you for letting me get through there. And I was curious if you're if either John or your guest there would care to comment on Eric Holder's recent lawsuit against the Arizona immigration law there before it even got put in effect, basically. And basically, I was curious as to what ramifications Mr. Holder's suit might have had he not sued under that specific part of the Constitution. In other words, why was it so narrow?
Well,
if you understand my question.
I think so. So I think first I want to say what effect this will have tomorrow on some of the primaries. This is obviously just a very hot-button issue in Republican primaries. The debate over illegal immigration is one of the defining issues in the Kansas primaries on the Republican side, and the Missouri and Michigan to maybe a lesser extent. This is something that's definitely, I think, going to get out some votes tomorrow that maybe wouldn't be voting otherwise. And this is something that I think, you know, it really invigorates the far right or the Republican Party. I guess the actual specific legal arguments over which section he filed suit under is maybe yet another reason why you guys should have a show on the 10th Amendment and power, difference between state and federal power. But it's something I'm again, don't quite feel qualified to answer that part of the question.
As a Wisconsin Public Radio talk show host, I'm not allowed to have any opinions, but I can suggest I can suggest to you that that when suits like this are filed, you always seek to narrow the playing field as much as possible. I mean, because it's much harder to control the outcome if your suit is on a legal point that is too broad. You can't know all the possible ramifications. And so lawyers, when they're putting things like this together, at least it's been my experience, that they're looking for a narrow point of law to sue on. And when you look at how the Supreme Court makes decisions, a lot of times they will be on an extremely narrow point. And so there's a purpose for this, and it has to do with the way laws are interpreted. So that's as close to an opinion as you're going to get from me today. Bill, thanks so much. Thanks so much for the call. 800-642-1234, a chance for you to get in. Here, as we have lines open for you right now, talk@WPR.org is the email address. Well, President Obama went to Detroit last week, but he didn't attend Chelsea Clinton's wedding. Was that perhaps the most overblown story of the week last week?
I didn't read much about it, so I guess my answer has to be yes. Daughters' weddings are not something on my to-do list personally. But.
Well, I didn't get an invite either. I wasn't surprised to see. But there was a lot of buzz in the blogosphere for a little bit, but then it doesn't take much to get that crew going. And more importantly, perhaps Congress failed to pass the Disclose Act, which was supposed to help reverse some of the effects of the Supreme Court decision on corporate election spending. They could not, to no one's surprise, get 60 votes in the Senate to overcome GOP resistance. Is the fact that they attempted to do this something that the Democrats can say, well, we tried to do this, but the Republicans wouldn't let us?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fairly unpopular issue that the Republicans support for the general electorate. You know, I mean, campaign finance and making elections more fair, whether that's the actual final outcome of some of these acts or not, is something that I think really appeals to voters. So it's always one of those votes that I think is a little dangerous for Republicans to make, and you can see national political figures like John McCain making a career out of pointing out the importance of these issues and bucking his party on that. In Wisconsin, you know, Feingold and his views on this, you know, he has a very tough Senate race, and in some ways having the Republicans oppose this and defeat this may be something that proves to be important in him in the upcoming election.
Well, you brought up Senator Feingold. It's an interesting case if you look at his history. I mean, he's been sort of a contrarian and has campaign finance has been one of his big issues. He has done very well at raising small amounts of money from individuals. And he's run campaigns that are sort of based on that. But Wisconsin seems to respect Mavericks a little bit. And every time someone says, oh, Feingold's dead, I always say, well, you know what, I want to wait until Election Day to make that guess, because he has found ways to convince people to vote for him in spite of whoever is running against him and what the issues might be. How much trouble do you think that Senator Feingold may be in here in Wisconsin, do you?
Well, this is obviously one of his tougher elections, it looks like, in his recent cycles. But, you know, if at all the polls I've looked at, it looks like he's definitely leading. It's still kind of early to know for sure. But if the election was held today, I would think that he would win.
Well, as they say, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip.
Yes.
It's a while until November. And that's another thing I wanted to ask you about. You know, all of these polls and things, and everybody's quoting, well, people feel like this today or feel like that today. And we've been hearing about this since, oh, God, I mean, last year. You know, well, this is, you know, well, this poll says this. And how important are these opinion polls to people other than journalists? This far out from the election, I mean, isn't the opinion poll that really counts the one that happens when people go in the booth and vote?
Yeah, obviously, yeah, that's the one that really counts, and especially in primaries, the polling's difficult to do anyway. It's really hard to figure out who's going to go out in our 100-degree heat tomorrow and actually vote in Kansas tomorrow. You know, I think this is just, it's kind of a bigger issue. We want to be able to talk about politics, and, you know, I encourage people to actually use polls instead of just making things up or relying on their feelings. But polls change, and we know that. The 1982 midterms is kind of a great example of this. If you look at 1982, President Reagan's approval ratings are kind of falling, unemployment's very high. But, you know, things kind of changed before the election, and Reagan did very well in 84 after things changed. The midterms weren't as bad as I think everybody thought they'd be. But, you know, again, several months out, things look pretty horrible. And trying to guess what will happen in aggregate, I think we can get some good ideas of whether, you know, the Democrats or Republicans will take control of the House or Senate. But in terms of individual races, I think it's pretty tough.
All right, Zeke in Illinois wants to join in our discussion. Zeke, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for putting me on. I appreciate it. And I appreciate your voice. I listen to Kathleen Dunn a lot, but I've enjoyed you in particular today.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And the reason is because you're a breath of fresh air of any media. It's for people to actually challenge, like your guest, for example, who seems to be really kind of a nice guy, a little bit smug there about that, saying that, oh, it's always the Democrats do things too. But nobody wants to say the truth, and that is the Republicans, these guys, weasels, get away with lying constantly, and nobody challenges them. He just said before, oh, well, both parties, political parties do it. You know what? Not even close. It's a constant drumbeat every day on Fox News of lies and deceit. I see it every day with these people spew these lies to me. For exactly one, I want to ask this to your guest in particular, and that is the deficit. Fox News and the other lying media has people convinced that Barack Obama accumulated all this debt. Let me just ask your guy there. Are you aware that George Bush ran up a debt for 8 years, a phenomenal debt, and prior to that, Ronald Reagan did? Are you aware of that at all, or just disregard that since Obama?
Well, hey, let's give the professor a chance to respond because we're almost out of time. You are aware of the debt?
Sure. Bush almost doubled it, and it looks like Obama's on track to do the same thing. Politicians say things that the public want to hear, and the public likes low taxes and high spending. And this is something both parties take advantage of in slightly different ways, but they both take advantage of. And my fear is that, it's our children and grandchildren that are going to pay the price of us looking at the short term instead of the long term.
Let's, gee whiz. Oh, you know what? I don't think we're going to be able to get any more. Well, let's try it. I'll do the dumb thing today. John in Green Bay, make it quick because we're almost out of time.
Quick comment. I believe that the Republican Republicans will push Obama to either veto a complete reissue of the Bush tax cuts, or he'll end up vetoing it, and that will be the largest tax increase in history. One quick other thing is that keep in mind, though, a person that makes $250,000 currently and under the new tax code, or though would be paying that made $300,000 would be paying approximately $2,000 a year more on that next $50,000 of income.
Okay. Well, President Obama might not have to veto anything if Congress just doesn't act.
If Congress doesn't act, the taxes go up. Congress has to act in the affirmative to maintain any of the Bush tax cuts. I have a hard time thinking that Obama would actually veto the whole thing if that's what goes through and forces the tax cuts. Because of the sunset provision, this is a very weird procedure where it just doesn't work like normal. We don't get to kind of sit back and decide what we want to do. It happens unless we do something.
Okay.
That's why it's going to be such an important issue before November.
Well, I had a whole other list of things we didn't get to. That's typical of this program. But, Professor, thanks for your expertise here this morning. I appreciated our conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Michael Lynch, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Kansas. All things political every Monday morning at 9 o'clock. Next week, Kathleen will be back. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. On-air production by Dave Potras. Thanks for joining us. Stick around. We're going to talk about gravity next hour. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of WPR.